This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's 10 years after 9/11. Al-Qaeda has bombed malls and casinos, blown up subways and trains, shot down airliners. Congress has passed Patriot Acts 2 and 3. Oil costs $85 a barrel, and the U.S. economy is withering. In this month's Atlantic Monthly, Richard Clark offers a sobering assessment of the war on terror in the guise of a fictional lecture delivered on September the 11th, 2011. The speaker asserts that no one can say now that we won the war on terror, and concludes by wondering what we might have done differently. Later in the program, the country's largest denomination of Lutherans releases its long-awaited report on gays and lesbians in the church. But first, the war on terror, and we welcome your questions for Richard Clark about his time as counterterror advisor to the last three presidents, about the book he published last year, Against All Enemies, and in particular, about the future of the battle against Al-Qaeda and its allies. Does the failure to attack in the U.S. since 9/11 give you hope? Do you worry that the threat has been blown out of proportion or taken too lightly? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Richard Clark joins us here in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Your article in the Atlantic Monthly describes a sequence of low-tech, low-cost, at least low-cost to Al-Qaeda attacks, but maybe not at the targets most people expect.
Well, I think most people expect the attacks, if they come in the future, to be again against iconic buildings like the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the White House, the Congress, and they expect the attacks to be only in New York or Washington. The purpose of this article is to say we know through expert reports, congressional hearings, think tank research, we know that we have a number of vulnerabilities, and we're not doing anything about them, or we're doing very little about them. And as long as those vulnerabilities exist, it is possible for someone, Al-Qaeda or some new follow-on, to attack those vulnerabilities. What I tried to do was make vivid for the reader what would happen if someone did attack those vulnerabilities. And the point of the article is to say, let's get on with doing what we said we would do and really do homeland security, and also have a public debate and dialogue about it and about how civil liberties, privacy rights, and security relate to each other.
One of the things you suggest in this article is the that the attackers in this putative future war on terror, the attackers are not necessarily the Saudis or the Arabs we would expect them to be.
Well, they could be any number of people. There are Al-Qaeda people in Indonesia and in the Philippines who certainly aren't Arab. There are Iraqi terrorists who are not Al-Qaeda, who are simply mad at us because we've invaded their country. The point is not to worry so much about who might attack us, but to worry about how they might attack and to begin now to do the things that the president said we would do after September 11th, and that is to reduce our vulnerabilities here at home.
In the what we might have done differently section, your fictional lecturer at September the 11th, 2011, looks back and says, look, one thing that we have done is made it much more difficult for people to stage attacks. That's, if we've been successful, that's what we've been successful at. We have hardened the country. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, there are several things that we know we should be doing. For example, last March 11th, there was a major Al-Qaeda attack in Spain on six trains, commuter trains, 2,000 casualties, 200 dead. That could happen today in Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco, any city that has a large commuter rail system. And we know that in most of those cities, little or nothing has been done to prevent that kind of attack. We know that in Las Vegas, Al-Qaeda surveilled casinos. And yet when the FBI called the casino security people and owners of the casinos and said, come down to the FBI office so we can talk about this, some of them responded by saying, oh no, we don't want to know about it, because then we might be legally liable if something happened. Chemical plants, airlines, there are a whole series of things where we know Al-Qaeda has planned attacks or has carried out attacks, and yet these things remain vulnerable.
The other aspect of the article, that's on the domestic side, the other aspect of the article is on the foreign side, and you continue, you've been highly critical of the war in Iraq, and you continue to describe it in this article as the greatest recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think it's a breeding ground for terrorists. People who lived in Iraq and had nothing to do with terrorism, who would never think of taking up a gun against the United States, now are willing to lose their lives in order to kill Americans because we went into their country, because we did things like take a city of 250,000 people, Fallujah, and essentially eliminate it, make it uninhabitable. If 1% of the people who lived in Fallujah now decide to make their life's work attacking the United States, then there's a large terrorist force. It doesn't take many terrorists to have terrible effect. We saw on September 11th how only 20 people could have an extraordinary effect on our nation.
And that is one of the disturbing aspects of this article. In this sequence of attacks on all of these different targets, it turns out that these, if you add them up, a few scores of people would have been involved. As you point out, 50 pounds of explosives could in one day accomplish the destruction of the National Rail passenger system, something that Congress has been struggling with for the past 30 years.
What I tried to prove in these series of hypothetical fictional events is that a small number of terrorists with unsophisticated weaponry, or no weaponry at all in the case of September 11th, they used our own airplanes as weapons, how a small number of terrorists with fairly unsophisticated resources could have a terrible effect on our economy because we haven't done the things that we know we should be doing to harden the country.
Our guest is Richard Clark, the author of Against All Enemies, and most recently the author of an article in the Atlantic Monthly 10 years later. If you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And let's begin with James, who calls us from Davis, California.
Yes, hi. I'm an engineer with the University of California, Davis, and I just wanted to ask, does the government have a team or departments of engineers that are working on eventualities and possible scenarios? Because engineers that I studied with and work with ever since September 11th, we sit around and postulate and theorize about, oh, gosh, it would be so easy to do this with the Bay Bridge or the Sacramento River or, you know, various engineering structures, buildings, chemical plants, et cetera. And given the fact that I specialize in failure analysis, I mean, the people that I work with, it's sort of frightening the relative ease with which these, you know, attacks could be carried out.
Failure analysis, is that a growth industry? I'm just joking there, James, but Richard Clark, why don't you give us an answer there?
Well, I think the United States government has enormous resources, including engineers on staff and engineers that they can get from contractors and think tanks. Knowing what the problem is not the issue. We know that these things are vulnerable chemical plants. Senator Corzine from New Jersey walked on to a chemical plant carrying what could have been a bomb and walked out of the plant, and no one noticed. No one noticed Senator Corzine or the 60 Minutes camera crew that was following him onto the chemical plant. We know what the vulnerabilities are. The issue is, are we doing enough to reduce them?
Well, so then the question is, do we have the resources, military power, police power, et cetera, to patrol things like the Golden Gate Bridge or, water treatment plants, et cetera?
Yeah, or are there new technologies that can make it easier for us to do it without employing the entire country as policemen or guards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are. We know the technologies have been developed after September 11th. American researchers and engineers and industry turned their attention towards security and have invented all sorts of new technologies that make it easier to guard facilities and to protect things. But most of that technology hasn't been bought. Very little of it has been implemented.
James?
Well, thanks so much. Neil, appreciate it.
Appreciate the phone call, James. One thing that you write about in the article is a sort of national identification card that includes all sorts of biometric. You call it the SID, the SID for short. This is something that, at least trying to read between the lines, you seem to advocate.
Well, what I'm not sure I do. I advocate improved security of identity because about 9 million Americans a year are victims of identity theft. And some of that can be by terrorists. We know in the case of September 11th that they were using phony identifications. But what I'm trying to point out is that there is a need in this country for a dialogue now before additional attacks about what we are willing as a people to do in terms of increasing security and where we draw the line in terms of privacy rights and civil liberties. Some kinds of identity cards might cross the line. But we should have that dialogue now, Neil, before we have additional attacks, because as we learned after September 11th, once an attack, a big attack, occurs, we pass legislation very quickly. We jump to conclusions and solutions very quickly after an attack, in the panic after an attack. It's better to have these serious discussions as a nation about where are we willing to go with things like national identity cards before such an attack.
Yet is it possible to frame that discussion profitably when there has been no attack since 9/11, when there have been no sleeper cells uncovered by the FBI?
Well, I think that's the job of the President and the Homeland Security Secretary and of the Congress to get that dialogue going and say to the American people, as in fact the President did throughout the campaign, future terrorist attacks are possible. He said that throughout the campaign. Now that the campaign is over, he needs to say it again and say, because additional terrorist attacks are possible, we need to have a debate about these issues.
Richard Clark is our guest. His article in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine is America Attacked, the sequel looking back from 2011 and imagined history. He's also, of course, been a counterterrorism advisor to the past three presidents. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about September 11th, 2011. Where will we be in the war on terror? Our guest is Richard Clark, author of a new article in the Atlantic Monthly. You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. And Fred is with us from Walla Walla, Washington.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
It is afternoon on your coast, isn't it?
You bet.
I have for years, Mr. Clark, been just stunned at what I have access to when I walk into my local hardware store or when I drive down to a local gasoline station to refill a propane tank for my barbecue. The sorts of things that could be done with materials that are so easily available, it's stunning to contemplate. I'm wondering, with respect to the dialogue that you're advocating that we as a nation undertake to figure out how much we're willing to put up with, where in that dialogue is the line between kind of surveilling people and their uses of materials, common materials, versus controlling access or monitoring access to the materials themselves before they get into individuals' hands?
Well, I think there are some materials that perhaps you should have a license for. There are some materials that you can get now that perhaps you shouldn't be able to get. I'm thinking of 50-caliber rifles. 50-caliber rifles, there's no possible reason why anyone should have a 50-caliber rifle, but you can buy that. You can buy an assault weapon. You can buy all sorts of fertilizers that are easily made into explosives. We should probably have a blue ribbon panel, take a look at that array of things and see what should be prohibited, what should you need a license for, what should you have to fill out a form with your name and address and identification, simply saying that you are you when you buy it, and what should be publicly available. Now, propane tanks are always going to be publicly available, at least I hope. I can run my barbecue.
I do too.
But at the other end, why can anyone buy a ton of ammonium perchlorate, which could easily be turned into a big truck bomb?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. In in your three administrations worth of service to our government, have these sorts of questions even come up as hypotheticals for potential discussions at some point down the road?
Well, they did, some of them. Certainly in the Clinton administration, the assault weapon ban was motivated in part because we didn't want terrorists to be able to get them so easily in the United States. We also asked the Congress to put trace materials in certain chemicals so that after they were used, now that's not terribly useful, but it's of some use, after they were used, you could trace back to see who bought them and where they came from. And the National Rifle Association not only opposed the assault weapon ban, which I can understand, but they also opposed putting trace materials in chemicals, which I could not understand.
Nor can I.
Fred, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Christian, and Christian is calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, thanks, Neil. Clark, I got a question for you, sir. And I'm a great admirer of your work over the years, and I want to thank you for being a hard-working citizen of this land.
Thank you.
But the question is, I know you're not with the regime, with the current government, but, you know, you have tremendous power and influence within the government, and you have some of these strong insights and very, very basic issues that the government has not made any move to make changes to. The question is, how far have you gone, or what are you possibly doing to be able to still let your influences do the job?
Well, I wouldn't want to overstate my influence in the current administration, but I have, since the Atlantic Monthly magazine came out, I've received calls from people in a number of federal agencies and departments saying, thank you for writing the article. It makes vivid what we've been trying to tell people, that these things could happen. And we are distributing it in our agency. We are sending it up to our boss. I've had congressional offices call and say that they've given it to the senator or they've given it to the congressman. And frequently, I mean, my experience in several administrations was the way you got people's attention was to make a future possibility vivid. And that's why in several administrations we had exercises where we had cabinet members and deputy cabinet members role play themselves in a particular future crisis. That made them think about what the effect would be of a nuclear bomb going off in the United States, what would happen if there were a biological weapon used in the United States. And so I thought, based on that experience of getting cabinet members' attention by putting them in exercise scenarios, what if we could get their attention now by portraying for them how several different scenarios could come about without nuclear weapons, without biological weapons, with easy-to-obtain materials, with small numbers of terrorists, and yet have a truly devastating effect?
Christian, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
As I'm sure you know, Mr. Clark, there has been some criticism of this article. Some suggest that you're now in private business as the head of a consultancy firm, trying to drum up some business for yourself.
Well, I've got more business than I could possibly do. I'm not interested in additional business. And in any event, the kind of business I do has very little to do with protecting trains or chemical plants or nuclear plants or aircraft.
Here's an email question from Avi Vardy in Bala, Pennsylvania. To what extent did the war on Iraq damage the real war on terror, in your opinion?
Well, I think it destroyed the war on terror. It made it almost impossible to win the war on terror. And one of the things the fictional professor says in the lecture in the Atlantic Monthly is, what if instead of going into Iraq, what if we had concentrated all of that money and all of that attention on going after Al-Qaeda and reducing our vulnerabilities here at home? For the money that we are spending in Iraq going after weapons of mass destruction that we now are told don't exist, we could have eliminated most of these vulnerabilities here in the United States. That was the choice that the president had, and unfortunately he chose wrong, in my opinion. It's not too late, however. We can still direct the necessary resources at making ourselves more secure here at home.
Your fictional professor paints a pretty bleak picture of the future for both Iraq and Afghanistan. And while you can look at Afghanistan and see that there are still a lot of problems, Afghanistan is certainly not the disaster area many feared.
No, it's not. And if we continue our aid levels there, and if we continue our presence there, and if NATO continues its presence there, there's hope in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, in Iraq, no one who really knows Iraq sees a rosy scenario. Brent Scowcroft, the first President Bush's national security advisor, suggested a few weeks ago that perhaps after the election, we will move to a civil war because the election will polarize, the results of the election will polarize people. Apparently, a CIA report, according to the Washington Post, a CIA report about what the future of Iraq will be, says that more likely than not, it is going to be in chaos for the foreseeable future.
Let's get another listener on the line, and this will be Margaret. Margaret's calling from Nashville.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Thank you, Mr. Clark, for all your good work. I had two questions quickly. One is, in your estimation, why did Bush make the choice to not pursue al-Qaeda and not strengthen us here at home? The other question is, how vulnerable are our government, financial, and, for instance, electrical grid computer systems to being hacked?
Those are two great questions. It's hard for me to guess why the president chose the way he did. I think he believed that his own rhetoric, that we should take the fight to the terrorists overseas. You know, he kept saying that we want to fight them over there so that they don't come here. And it takes about 30 seconds of analysis to realize just because we're fighting them overseas doesn't prevent them from coming here. But I think he believed his own rhetoric. And I don't think anyone actually gave him a detailed plan or option or analysis. You can do Iraq, Mr. President, or you can protect America. And here are the costs and here are the alternatives. With regard to the computer networks that control the electric power grid and other key infrastructures, I have said for a long time that they're very vulnerable. But now we have a whole chorus of experts in the Congress, in think tanks, even in the Department of Homeland Security, saying that these infrastructures that are controlled by cyber networks are vulnerable. We saw, for example, a nuclear power plant in Ohio that had to go offline because a computer worm that was working its way through the Internet and got its way into the nuclear power plant. There are lots of examples of airlines, Delta Airlines, Continental Airlines, having to cancel all flights because of computer glitches.
Yeah, with Calm Air just a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
That's right, at Christmas. There is a very good plan that the administration published about how to secure America's cyberspace. But according to the Inspector General at the Homeland Security Department, the administration has done almost nothing to implement its own plan to secure our cyberspace.
Margaret, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Vic. Vic is calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Clark, I agree with you completely about the mistake that we made by going into Iraq. However, I'm wondering if there's ever going to be an end to this sort of cat-and-mouse game of catching terrorists unless we actually address the root causes of terrorism, the political causes, specifically the lack of peace in the Mideast. I don't think that we'll ever end this problem.
Well, imagine for me two circles, one within the other. And the innermost circle are the hardcore terrorists, the people who are willing to die fighting us in their jihad. No matter what we do in the Middle East peace process or anywhere else, those hardcore terrorists are not going to have their minds changed. And for them, we have to arrest them or take other measures against them, and we have to prevent them from being able to attack us here. Now, the larger circle around them are people who currently support the jihad with political influence, perhaps with money, or just ideological support. That group can, I think, be persuaded by what the 9/11 Commission called the Battle of Ideas. That's the target where we have to explain to them that the United States is not an evil nation, that we're not an irreligious nation, that we don't want to conquer the Islamic countries, and that we are a force for good in the world. And by doing things like the Arab-Israeli peace process, we will reinforce that.
But at the same point, political and economic freedom, liberty, those are just as important as peace in the area.
Absolutely. The battle of ideas.
Vic, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And let's go now to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's push the wrong button after that. And we'll talk with Christine. Christine is with us from Michigan.
Yes, you mentioned addressing vulnerabilities while balancing them with civil liberties. On March 6, 2003, two individuals, including a foreign national, were arrested at the U.S. Capitol for appearing dressed as suicide bombers. Ultimately, the charges were dismissed. The pair called it art, performance art. And I wonder, how does this set a precedent for real terrorists sending their artists in with real bombs? And how do you balance such performances?
Well, I think if you go to most airports now, there's a sign that says, as you approach the security zone, it says, do not make any jokes about security or bombs. And I think that's kind of the attitude we have to take in general.
Were charges dismissed in this case?
Well, I'm not familiar with the case, but
The individuals had entered, and they had loose clothing, and when they entered the U.S. Capitol, apparently the rotunda, they had all these objects strapped to their bodies in duct tape.
Mm-hmm. I think we already have laws that make that a crime in many locations. And it's just, this is not a joke. This is not something for performance art to walk into a place like the Capitol.
These individuals are walking around the country now and continuing such performances.
Well, you point to the general issue of security versus civil liberties here, and you cite one specific example. I think this is the kind of thing we should have a discussion about. For me personally, there are places where it's totally inappropriate for people to have that kind of performance art. If they do it in a theater, that's fine. If they do it in an airport, they ought to be arrested.
As you look at this, this is the thorny issue for many Americans. Do you think that we've become complacent after 9/11, that we've thought this was an incident rather than a campaign?
Well, what I try to lay out in the Atlantic Monthly article is that, yes, America got complacent after 3 years and no follow-on attacks in the United States. And there are a lot of people today who think that 9/11 happened, it'll never happen again, because we've had 3 years of relative peace. But during those 3 years, two things have happened. One, we have stirred up more terrorists, created more terrorists by our activities in Iraq. And two, we have not addressed the fundamental weaknesses and vulnerabilities in the United States. Those two things together put us at risk, making more terrorists on the one hand and ignoring our vulnerabilities here at home.
Do you fear that by publicizing the possibilities of more terrorist attacks in this country, you will, one of the things you write about in this article is vigilante attacks against Muslims, against mosques?
No, I don't think so. I think what if this article has any effect at all, it will be on causing people to ask questions about why this or that system hasn't been secured. It'll cause people in Boston to say, why hasn't the T subway been secured? It'll cause people in New Jersey and Delaware to say, why don't we have better security at the chemical plants? That's what I'm hoping for.
And one final question. We just have a few seconds left, but aren't you fearful that in some respects you're laying out a plan of attack for America's enemies?
Neil, they already know how to do it, and they know in greater detail than I've laid out, far greater detail. By the way, throughout this article, there are footnotes to real reports indicating that the terrorists already know how to do this stuff.
Richard Clark, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure, Neil.
Richard Clark's article is in the latest issue of the Atlantic Monthly. It's called America Attacked, the sequel, looking back from 2011, an imagined history. Richard Clark is also the author of Against All Enemies. He was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, the largest Lutheran denomination releases its study on gays and lesbians in its church. Join us The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.